You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
This is Field Talk. I'm Liza Lester. Tallgrass Prairie once dominated the landscape of the Midwestern United States before settlers sowed the land into the current patchwork of wheat, corn, soy, and cattle. My guest, Jesse Nippert, is a scholar of the tall grass, a Kansas boy, and an assistant professor at Kansas State University. In the rolling Flint Hills of eastern Kansas, he's watching change overtake a remnant of old prairie never touched by the plow. His article describing positive feedbacks promoting the creeping spread of woody shrubs in native grassland appears in the November edition of ESA's online-only journal, Ecosphere. Ecosphere launched in August of 2010. Jesse Nippert, where is the tall grass prairie? Does wild prairie still exist in North America?
So geographically, the tall grass prairie ranges from Illinois to the east to we're at about the western extent of it here in eastern Kansas, but then as far north as the Canadian prairies in Saskatchewan and then down to Texas. Historically, the tall grass prairie was this massive ecosystem of roughly 240 million acres. But at the end of the 19th century, with the invention of the steel plow, most of it was converted to agriculture. By as early as the 1930s, 1940s, less than 1% of the tall grass prairie actually remained. So in the short course of about 50 years, essentially the majority of an ecosystem was lost. The only areas that actually still remain that were never converted to agriculture are those that it was economically unfeasible to do so. So they were either too rocky or too steep, or there was some other reason why they couldn't be converted to corn or wheat or beans or whatever. It was this once vast region, and most of it is now just exists as remnants, although the field of restoration ecology has taken on the tallgrass prairie with a vengeance. And now all throughout Iowa and Illinois and Kansas and Nebraska, restoration ecologists are looking at ways to bring this system back and understand the processes by which it develops.
Is the Konza Biological Station that you work at one of these remnants, or is that something that was established by reclaiming agricultural land?
Konza Prairie Biological Station is located just outside of Manhattan, Kansas, and it's about 8,000 acres. It's native tallgrass prairie. It was never converted to agriculture, largely because it's really hilly and it's really rocky. The Konza Prairie is part of the broader Flint Hills region that extends from the northern portion of Kansas down into the northern portion of Oklahoma. And most of the original tallgrass prairie pockets that remain all reside in this Flint Hills ecoregion. The Konza Prairie Biological Station just celebrated its 40th anniversary. It's unique in that it's jointly owned by Kansas State University and the Nature Conservancy. The tallgrass prairie in particular is a pretty interesting system in that it's maintained by disturbance. You have this system that fire, grazing, and strong climatic variability is what makes this system stay the same. Because if you alter the fire dynamics or you remove grazers for the system, most of the tallgrass prairie ecoregion gets enough precipitation that it would quickly transform into being a forest. Only the maintenance of this disturbance processes keep tallgrass prairie as tallgrass prairie.
What do those disturbances look like today with all the changes in the landscape? Do we have fire coming through these areas? Do we have grazers that would represent something that looked like historical grazing on this tall grass?
Of the three variables, the bison, which were once, of course, the main grazers of the system, have functionally been replaced by cattle. And for all intensive purposes, it's a pretty good equivalent response. The maintenance of the system is somewhat dependent upon how ranchers manage their herd and the densities in which the animals exist on the landscape. Here in the Flint Hills region, burning is still very common. A large portion of the Flint Hills is burned every spring. This annual burning promotes the growth and development of the C4 grasses. So the grasses that give the tallgrass prairie its name are big blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, little blue stem. C3 species examples are most of the trees on the planet. Other common examples would be wheat and rice, and, you know, most of the diversity of the plant life is C3 species. Our grasses are C4, so C4 grasses are generally fairly drought tolerant. These C4 grasses are also very efficient with nitrogen. So the C4 species essentially evolved in response to both low CO2 conditions as well as dry conditions. This is a mechanism to allow these species to maximize growth under non-optimal conditions. And C4 species are more susceptible to cold temperatures. So generally you don't see C4 species in cooler regions of the planet. Here in North America, that lines in around the range of South Dakota. As these C4 grasses keep most of their meristems below ground, you can essentially bite off the top and they quickly can regrow and continue to grow, you know, whether they're mowed or grazed or you have some other disturbance like removal by fire. And by burning in the spring, it promotes their growth and development. And then the highly nutritious C4 grasses are great feed for the livestock that depend upon them. So it's this relationship between fire, which promotes C4 grass growth, and then the C4 grass growth is beneficial for the animals on the landscape.
So these are prescribed burns that ranchers are taking to deliberately.
Yeah, that's right. Ranchers go out and they burn their prairie, you know, every year in April. And then within roughly 2 weeks or so, new grass growth is initiated and livestock essentially can be on immediately. These C4 grasses are really robust. They've essentially evolved both with grazers and disturbance such that they can withstand quite a bit of pressure. At the Kansa Prairie Biological Station, one of the things that we've done over the last 30 years is manipulate how frequently the landscape is burned. And so we have units of the site that are burned every year, as well as every 2 years, every 4 years, and then long-term unburned to see what's the implications of stopping burning altogether. The one thing, though, that we do know is that this region has always been burned, whether it was by dry lightning prior to European arrival or by the Native Americans, which would burn to help manage bison populations, because bison track recently burned areas that have just been burned. The bison show up the next spring, because this grass is the most nutritious. One of the current ecological concerns worldwide, at least for grassland ecosystems, is a process called woody encroachment. And woody encroachment is happening essentially on every continent except Antarctica. The predominant species that is causing this transition in tallgrass prairie is Cornus drummondii, or roughleaf dogwood. It's a native species to North America, but the cover of Cornus drummondii is increasing rapidly in tallgrass prairie. I have a very, try to think of the best word to describe it. I have a very enthusiastic PhD student named Zach Radizak, and he started trying to identify what are some of the drivers, and what Zach found is while the C4 grasses predominantly use soil moisture from the top 25 centimeters of the soil, over 80% of the water that's being used by the shrub exists at regions deeper than that. And just like grasslands in all systems, water is generally the primary regulator of growth and productivity in this system. So now, by using deeper soil moisture, the shrubs essentially are not competing with the grasses for this critical limiting resource. One of the other things that's unique about Cornus drummondii, and actually woody encroachment in general, is it's a clonal species. As the clonal stems are developing, they're actually using water transferred through the rhizomes out to the developing stems.
So because it can send out these shoots, essentially replicating itself, not creating new seedlings, it's able to tap this water that the adult plant already has access to, and this is how it's escaping competition.
So you can imagine that now, free from competition with the grasses for water and using water from deeper depths, they just send out new developing clonal stems on the perimeter of this expanding island. And then as those clones develop and become mature, they then tap into water down deep, and the cycle essentially continues across the landscape. So what makes this system actually become a reinforcing dynamic or a positive feedback is that the dogwood, as it ages and the clones get larger, they actually decrease the amount of fuel that's being produced. And as I mentioned, the tallgrass prairie is completely dependent upon fire for the maintenance of the system. If you remove fire, the system essentially transforms from being a grassland into a shrubland or a forest. And so as this dogwood is expanding across the land surface, there's less fuel. With less fuel, when you do burn, the fire doesn't carry. And essentially it's saving itself from the fire. So in this way, it's increasing its cover across the landscape very quickly. Just on the short time frame over the 30 years that the Konza Prairie has been in existence, you know, entire watersheds have went from being C4 grassland dominated systems to almost, you know, complete cover, at least in the lowland areas, by this woody shrub.
Even in areas that are burning more frequently, you still see these shrubs expanding their range.
Yeah, so when you look at woody encroachment worldwide, there's been a whole slew of mechanisms that have been posited to account for this phenomenon, and they've included everything from elevated CO2 to other climate change factors to changes in the frequency of burning to overgrazing to nitrogen deposition. At the Konza Prairie, some of these things haven't changed. You know, we're not overgrazing the system. And woody encroachment occurs whether it's grazed or not grazed. And woody encroachment at our site is actually occurring on watersheds that are burned every 4 years, and even on some that are burned every 2 years. The long-term estimated fire record for this site, so how frequently did the Konza Prairie burn historically, is estimated at about every 4 years, whether that was by Native Americans or by lightning. The interesting phenomenon is our 4-year burn watersheds have the fastest and most pronounced rate of woody encroachment of any other location on the site. So it's not fire suppression that's resulting for this. It's some other phenomenon that's helping get individuals established. And then once established and they survive their first fire, this shrub, essentially now free from competition for water with the grasses, can start expanding across the landscape through the production of these clonal stems.
And so you're saying that you think there's some new variable that you're not clear what it is that's allowing it to establish itself?
Yeah, so one of the key questions that remains unanswered are, what are the drivers of initial establishment? The most likely explanation for this is actually probably elevated CO2, or here in the center part of North America, nitrogen deposition is a real concern. You know, it's one of these two factors, more than likely, either elevated CO2 or nitrogen deposition, that's increasing the likelihood of an individual getting established despite the historic fire frequency. Because once established, burning every year doesn't get rid of shrub encroachment. The key question to be answered still is, what's driving establishment?
Tell us a little bit about nitrogen deposition. Where is it coming from? What are the problems?
Nitrogen deposition is essentially the passive fertilization of the planet. We synthesize so much more nitrogen now than is naturally occurs, and it either rains down in a wet form or a dry form everywhere. The sources of nitrogen deposition are from everything from automobile exhaust to feedlots to just industrial plumes from cities. There are certain regions of North America that are more impacted by nitrogen deposition, and generally it's these regions here in the center part of the country or in the areas along the East Coast or around the Great Lakes region. The general consequence of nitrogen deposition is, with more available nutrients, some organisms are better adapted to uptake these nutrients, grow, and prosper than others. So it results in sort of a shifting community dynamic over time and altered productivity. So nitrogen deposition can largely just be thought about as sort of passive fertilization of the planet.
So are both nitrogen and CO2 providing basically nutrients that those shrubs need? Are grasslands better at dealing with low nutrient situations?
Well, elevated CO2 and increased nitrogen are going to facilitate faster growth by C3 species. So these woody shrubs are C3, and with faster initial growth as a seedling, perhaps it allows them to be able to become established and then survive their first fire. Now, elevated CO2 and increased nitrogen should have less of a positive effect for the C4 community. C4 species, they generally respond less to fertilization with nitrogen than C3 species.
Is this encroachment of woody shrubs happening on grazeland as well as in the prairie preserves?
Yeah, it happens regardless. Overgrazing seems to have the potential to facilitate that conversion faster, but even just grazing at appropriate densities still can result in that transformation of a grassland into a shrubland.
So is this something that the agricultural sector is concerned about as well?
Yeah, so to ranchers, obviously their livelihood depends upon the maintenance of their land staying a grassland. Ranchers can ensure their land stays a grassland either by the application of herbicides or mechanical removal. They stop this process from happening, whereas that's not possible on a lot of other large tracts of land because economically it's just unfeasible.
Mm-hmm. Do you have much opportunity to work with farmers and ranchers in your area, or is that fostered with the university? Are people open to that kind of communication and cooperation?
Yeah, absolutely. The largest source of revenue for the state of Kansas is the livestock industry. We do actually have a lot of meaningful interactions with the ranchers and landowners here in the Flint Hills region. To this extent, a lot of the practices at the Kansas Prairie Biological Stations mimic the processes that they're using so that we can provide to them some of the ecological mechanisms that result in the landscape characteristics and feature they have seen now for a long time. You know, a lot of the ranching communities, the same land has been within a family for generations and generations and generations. And while they might not know the exact mechanisms responsible for which plants exist there, they do have this unbelievable understanding of their land and know with amazing detail what's going to happen if you perturb it in one way or the other. To be really honest, if anyone is learning more from the other, it's probably us from them. It's just a real benefit for us to try and emulate some of their management practices so that we can better understand the ecology of the system. Because we live in a time right now where there's a lot of financial uncertainty, and the NSF is hardly immune from having to make tough decisions on how to allocate funding, the only other thing that I would like to point out is the value of long-term ecological research. A lot of the broader themes in that publication in Ecosphere wouldn't have been possible without having this archived data collection that spans 30 years. And so right now when we live in a theme where we need immediate payoff and you hear all of the common buzzwords around Washington, D.C. about, you know, accountability to the American people and fiscal responsibility, one of the best ways, in my opinion, that we can be investing some of our research dollars is at these long-term field stations. I love the grasslands. It's one of these systems that sort of seems simple at first, and then the longer you study it, the more transfixed you are by the processes therein. And I also think that the longer you're here, the less likely you are to leave, because you start to see the inherent beauty, and yeah, then you become a grassland ecologist.
Jesse Nippert's article, Positive Feedbacks Amplify Rates of Woody Encroachment in Mesic Tallgrass Prairie, appeared in the November edition of Ecosphere. This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Gattelli. For a link to Dr. Gattelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.